Welcome to the Food Panda's interview from Frog Hop. Popcorn Shed has been making delicious gourmet popcorn for 10 years now. It's tasty, beautifully packaged, and it's perfect for gifting. In fact, I was lucky enough to receive a selection from my family for Christmas last year. It's a business that's growing fast, and I'm delighted to welcome Commercial Director and co-founder Sam Feller to tell us all about it. Welcome, Sam.
Hi, nice to be here.
I guess the first question is, can you tell us about Popcorn Shed and why you started the business?
Absolutely. We started making popcorn at home in 2014. And when I say we, it was my cousin and I. So my cousin, who's my first cousin, our mothers are actually sisters. That's how we are related. We started making gourmet popcorn in 2014 at home. We have always been massive, like really passionate foodies, and just fell in love with food from a young age. And then always sort of as kids growing up together, we would do a lot of baking together. And it just kind of developed from there. And we landed on popcorn at the time in 2014. It was a great sweet snack that everyone, all our friends and family enjoyed eating. And we actually started making it at home, initially. And then it sort of went on from there and kind of went out of control a little bit.
Excellent. What were you doing before? I mean, did you have any food training or expertise or?
No. So before Popcorn Shed, I was actually in the commercial property industry. So I had got a real estate degree from university, and I went into commercial property management. And I was in that industry for 6 years, worked my way up to an associate director in a West End commercial property consultancy. I became a chartered surveyor as well. But the thing is, that was during my 20s. And I think I was approaching my 30th birthday at the time. And, you know, Laura at the same time had been working in management consultancy for 8 or 9 years. And we were both looking for a new challenge. I think we both wanted to do something that we were really much more passionate about. So food was a natural fit for us. Laura was very, very passionate about, she wanted to build a brand. She was very much into the brand and the marketing side. And I wanted to do something that I was more passionate about. I wasn't massively fulfilled in my property career. And I kind of got to that age, late 20s, and thinking, if I don't do something now, I might never do it. So, we took the plunge ultimately. We started making popcorn at home, and then we did that, I would say, for probably a year to 18 months whilst we got our packaging together and we found our co-packer and all the rest of it. So we got all the pieces in place to start the business. And then we actually went full time on the business in September 2016, when we went to our first trade show, went to the Speciality and Fine Food Fair actually in London in September of 2016. And that was the week that we had literally just quit our jobs and gone full time.
Did you find that the role before, the skills and things you'd learned were useful in being in the food business?
No, not really. I mean, yes, in the sense that, you know, I had business. I had experience working with people, and, you know, it was more of a corporate environment. So there were a lot of processes around. And actually, some of those skills are transferable. Certainly the people skills and some of the structures that were in place in the corporate environment. But going into a startup in CPG, you know, consumer packaged goods industry, you know, there's so much to it that requires real business experience. And I had none of it. You know, I didn't have any finance experience, no procurement experience, pricing experience, sales, marketing, PR, you know, HR, like none of it. So that was all a very steep learning curve. I'd say the first 2 years particularly were really, really steep. And then after that, it kind of, obviously I'm still learning every day, but it kind of got a little bit easier after that.
Yeah, you can breathe a little bit.
Yeah.
Excellent. What's currently in the range, and what came first, and how do you tackle product development?
So we've got, I think it's almost 30 flavors now in the range. We do a whole range of different popcorn. So we have a mini pop range, which is a all natural vegan and gluten free product range. It's what we call our everyday range. You might have that as a packet of popcorn with maybe a sandwich at lunch or a mid afternoon snack. And then we have what we call our gourmet range or luxury range, where we do over 20 different flavors, and most of them are caramel coated flavored popcorn. So we do like salted caramel, which has got milk chocolate melted on top. We do like a couple of seasonal flavors like Christmas pudding and gingerbread popcorn. We do a chocolate popcorn with a cocoa caramel coating on it. We do a couple of savory flavors in that range as well, mostly cheese. So we do a say cheese, which is a cheddar cheese, and blue cheese and a goat's cheese flavor. So some of them are more bit more mainstream, and some of them are kind of a little bit more unique, let's say, some of those flavors.
You started with one flavor or a handful? Or
we actually started with three flavors. So salted caramel, pecan pie, and pop and choc. Actually, when we launched it, I think we called it rich chocolate, but it's since changed its name and its color to pop and choc a long time ago. And we've still got those three flavors in the range now. But over the years, product development's been a really core part of our growth story. So not just adding, you know, obviously adding flavors, but also adding pack formats. So we do like an 80 gram shed, what we call a shed, which is a bag in box popcorn, very appropriate for the gifting market and certain retail channels. And then we do like a snack pack in the same format, but much smaller bag, lower price point. You know, that goes into more sort of food service channels, and just it's more appropriate for those buyers that are looking for a lower price point. More recently, I'd say in the last 3 years, we've started to experiment outside of just the ready-to-eat popcorn. So we now do a make-at-home popcorn kit. We've got a couple of those where our customers can go pop the kernels at home on a stovetop or in an air popper, and then put some popcorn seasonings on top or melt some chocolate and drizzle that on top. We do a popping kernels bottle and a couple of other gifting products like a popcorn advent calendar. So we have some peripheral products to the main range, but the core is very much, you know, ready-to-eat gourmet popcorn.
How easy is it to establish a new product in the range? Because I guess there's a lot of time and money goes into developing the new flavor. Or
it's not that easy. And actually, as we've got bigger and more mature as a business, it's become, I'd say, more challenging and takes longer. I think we've got a few more maybe boxes to tick before we can sign off on a new product, because it's not just, you know, obviously quality of the product needs to work. We have to have full confidence in the supply chain, where it's coming from. The price needs to work. And then obviously you've got all the branding and everything. So that process now, I mean, it used to take us, believe it or not, we used to be able to turn around new product in about 4 or 5 months, which was, I think, really quick, you know, that from start to finish, you know, find supplier, packaging, you know, first orders, stock in and sell. Now it's more like, you know, 9 months to 12 months, I'd say. It takes us a long time. And actually, because we're a wholesale business, we're not producers, finding those suppliers of good quality product that is good enough to sit under the Popcorn Shed brand is probably the most challenging bit that we find. Finding those suppliers that can produce good quality product at the right price.
You say you initially started making at home in a shed, is that right?
Not quite. So what happened is we started making popcorn in Laura's mother's kitchen. So This is my auntie's kitchen, okay, in North London, in her home kitchen. And you have to remember, at this point, we didn't know how to make popcorn. So, I mean, I knew, you know, because I was quite into baking as a kid. So I knew broadly that you had to pop the corn and then flavor it. But I didn't know really much beyond that. So we started making popcorn. We started learning how to make caramel popcorn. So caramel popcorn, the way it's made is first of all, the popcorn is popped, and caramel popcorn, if you want a nice rounded kernel, you're going to want to air pop that popcorn. So we had to first of all work that out. And then we got a couple of domestic air poppers and learned how to air pop the popcorn. And then we started to learn how to make a caramel. And if you've ever made a caramel at home, maybe for a cake or in baking, you know, you've got to bubble it up in a hot temperature. It's butter, it's sugar, it's syrups in there and some flavorings. And actually learning how to make a really good tasting, good quality caramel took us really quite a long time in the initial stages. And I think, you know, on reflection, I think it probably took us a year to work it out. I think it took us a bit too long, but you know, at the time we didn't know what we didn't know. So we are where we are, as you say.
And then how have you sort of scaled up production, and how easy or difficult has that been?
So just going back to your previous question, in terms of the shed, so what happened was when we finally cracked the caramel recipe, we got, you know, everyone loved it. You know, my auntie loved it, you know, my parents loved it, all our family loved it, all our friends loved it. We got started getting lots and lots of requests, oh, can I have this for my party, this for my wedding, etc. And we ended up doing sort of more and more batch production in the kitchen. And after several weeks of this, it was sort of mounting up, and Laura and I are not the, like, the tidiest people. There was an increasing amount of mess and equipment and ingredients scattered all over this kitchen. And the frustration was building up and building up. And Laura's mother, in the end, turned around to us and said, right, I've had enough, out my kitchen, everything's going in the garden shed. So we put all the, we were banished to the garden shed, basically. All our equipment ended up in there. And she was like, you're not using my kitchen anymore. And then after, you know, a week or two, people were like, oh, where's your equipment? I was like, oh, it's in the shed. And, oh, yeah, the popcorn shed. And everyone started referring to it as the popcorn shed, this little garden shed in Laura's mum's back garden. And we were looking for a brand name at the time. And so we were like, oh, that's quite a catchy little name for a brand. So, yeah, that's the story. That's how we named the business. It actually is named after Laura's mother's garden shed in her back garden.
Because the packaging as well, the boxes are the kind of shed, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we've named those the sheds, and each of those sheds is branded and themed by occasion. So, you know, we have a peanut butter popcorn, which sits in a squirrel shed because squirrels like peanuts, and all the story on the side of the shed is all about the story of the squirrel shed. So, and all of those shed, all of the sheds, all the branding follows a similar story. It's very novelty for the category. In terms of answering your question about the scale up, so once we were banished to the garden shed, we realized we couldn't really do this at home. Popcorn is bulky. Caramel popcorn is messy and hot and sticky. So we needed to find a co-packer. And we searched around. We asked people in the industry. We went to industry events, asked anyone for help that we could find. And eventually we found our first co-packer, which was a Northern England based co-packer that was a popcorn specialist, and they happened to have the right equipment that could make our popcorn. And you know, we did, after some recipe development with them, which took probably another 5 or 6 months, we were ready to go and we placed our first orders.
So where are you currently selling, and how has that sort of changed and evolved as the business has grown?
Yeah, so we are an omni-channel business through and through. About 30% of our business is online. So when I say online, it's all channels online. That might be our own website, or Amazon is a big channel for us. Also on some of these Q-commerce or dropship marketplaces. So places like Not on the High Street, Etsy, eBay, we sell on a lot of those marketplaces, and then through our own site and Amazon. And then in terms of the wholesale side of the business, we sell into shops, direct to retail, and then we do a fair amount of gifting business as well. And in terms of those wholesale channels, we've got quite a lot of them. So specialty retail is core for us. That's farm shops, delis, garden centers, gift shops, and so on. And then food service is an increasingly big channel. We have a corporate offering where we offer popcorn with a branded logo on the pack to corporate channels. We do a fair amount with hampers and gift boxes. We sell into the travel market, so travel retail, airlines, airports, and we do a sizable amount of export business as well, mostly to Europe, but we do actually export to America, which is the home of popcorn, and further afield like Southeast Asia and far off places, I think bits of the Middle East and things like that. So it's pretty diverse, our sales, but we've got hundreds of different clients operating lots of different channels.
And is that a deliberate strategy to really kind of diversify the sales channels and protect, I suppose it protects the business, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. I'm a massive proponent I'm a big fan of basically businesses not relying on just one or two, you know, massive supermarket listings to drive the revenue, because how risky is that to have all your revenue with one customer? And if you get a D list, all of a sudden you're sitting on stock, you've got to look at redundancies. It's a massive risk. And I think we've successfully managed to de-risk our business by diversifying those sales channels. So, you know, yeah, we do get the occasional D list and maybe we'll lose a listing here and there, but actually overall, it doesn't make a massive impact to our, you know, the performance of the business. So Definitely. I'm a big fan of diversifying sales channels. In terms of whether it was a deliberate strategy or not, I can't say it was. Like, the first 2 or 3 years, I think we did definitely target supermarkets, and we tried to get into some of those national retailers. But we realized that we didn't really have the right product for them. We're an expensive luxury bag in box popcorn. They want to sell a bag of popcorn for £1 for a share bag. You know, we can't make it for that. And we just realized we couldn't compete on price. We just, you know, there was just no way. So we went down the premium luxury route. We made, you know, we went into the gifting markets where there was more of a demand for our type of product. And I just think we found with supermarkets, we just didn't have the right product. And also, what happened specifically with the category was that in 2016, when we launched, popcorn was growing double-digit growth every year. It was the darling of the snack category. It was, there were loads of different brands. Everyone was jumping on the bandwagon. And I think over the last 8 years, that growth has significantly declined. And actually, a lot of the supermarkets have cut back on shelf space for popcorn. And they've given it back over to crisps or other healthier snacks. So if you go into a supermarket in the UK now, you're likely to probably only see 3 or 4 brands, leading brands of popcorn. And one of them's going to be own label. And then 2 or 3, I'm not going to name them, but they may be legacy brands or very big brands that are producing at such scale that we could never compete. So that's why we've gone down the sort of speciality route.
It's a very different product, isn't it? That kind of share bag popcorn.
It is. I mean, our mini pop range is more akin to that because it's an oil popped flavored popcorn. Our mini pop range it's got a USP. So we use a much smaller kernel when we pop it. So it pops to a smaller shape, a smaller size. It's a bright white color as well. We use a Japanese hullless popcorn for that. But, you know, we're importing that corn from overseas. A lot of the popcorn that you'll find in the supermarkets is actually a hybrid form of the corn. So it's grown cheaply. It's got very good yields. And that's why it's so cheap to pop, to obviously buy in and pop and bag. Whereas ours is a more expensive kernel. It's not organically grown, but it's grown. It's non-GMO and it's grown in a more sustainable way. And it's non-hybrid. So, you know, the actual cost of the raw material is higher. But then we've got that USP. And actually, there's a market for alternative, you know, more premium, more luxury popcorn than the stuff you get in the supermarkets. We say one of our marketing statements on the mini pop is that no floss required, because I find with some of those supermarket brands, you put it in your mouth and, you know, you get bits of kernel stuck in your teeth. And, you know, people complain about it. We go to shows and people say, I don't eat popcorn. It gets stuck in my teeth, particularly older people. But actually, with our mini pot range, it virtually disintegrates in your mouth. It does have a hole, but it's so fragile and so thin that it doesn't get stuck in your teeth. And actually, we say everyone can eat it. You know, if you're, you know, older person or anyone from about the age of 6 and upwards can eat our popcorn.
I saw some stuff that the business has obviously grown enormously since 2016, but it really took off. And since I've written the question, I realized that there's a big event that might have driven this, but it really took off between sort of 2020 and 2021. Is you know, what changed and how have you maintained that growth? Because it isn't just like you had a spike during COVID. You've kind of really sustained that growth since as well.
Yeah, I think COVID was it was transformational, I think, for a lot of businesses, particularly, yeah, food and drink is a resilient sector, regardless of the economy. And we were definitely in a position as a business that we could capitalize on the e-commerce demand. Obviously, before COVID, we had an e-commerce website. We had a strong presence on Amazon already. And we just had that digital footprint. And then when COVID came along and all of a sudden, you know, some of the shops were closed, some of our channels just stopped ordering completely. I mean, we obviously do a fair amount to the leisure channel where we're selling into cinemas, theatres, amusement parks, and so on, and also food service. Those types of channels completely shut down, right? They were forced to close during COVID. But because we had that digital presence, we were able to capitalise on the demand on online channels. And we took advantage of that, I think. And we had, you know, obviously production was still open. We ramped up production in relation to the demand. I think we'd started building our new website actually pre-COVID. I think we'd started it in the January and all of a sudden in March, everything shut down and we were trying to speed it up. And eventually we relaunched the site in June. And I think having the new website as well really supported that online growth. In terms of some of the other growth that we've sustained through that. We got to a point where the business was growing, top line revenue was growing. We could invest in people and build a team around us. And we started hiring. I'm not saying we've got a huge team. We keep it really small, but we were able to invest in people and actually build a bit of a wholesale sales force and build, we managed to hire a digital marketer who could support the e-commerce growth and also an operations executive that would take over the day-to-day operations and running of the business, processing the B2B orders and so on. And I think that investment in people was so important for having a fundamental foundation for the growth.
At what point did you target wholesale? It sounds quite important to the business.
Wholesale was always I think we started with wholesale before we even started with e-com. So we launched at Specialty in Fine Food, which obviously is a trade event, and we were targeting buyers there. So we've always targeted wholesale from 2016 when we actually launched. So yeah, it's very much been a focus. I think the diversification in terms of the sales channels and some of the techniques that we've used to generate leads and go out and win business have definitely evolved and improved over time. You know, we've come away from like a reliance on trade shows to go and generate buyer leads. And we're much more focused on other ways, more innovative ways of generating buyer leads, some of which is obviously organic marketing. I think brands reach a point where you get your SEO working and you start to get a lot more incoming inquiries. And that we definitely saw that over COVID. I think the wave started coming in and we started getting all this inbound, which was great. I think it took us probably 3 years to start getting some of those inquiries come in, but it did happen organically. But then also we obviously go out and go and find clients ourselves and go win clients through cold outreach efforts. And I think some of our techniques that we've used, you know, particularly in that period, 2020, 2021, we've just become a bit more sophisticated in some of the techniques that we employ and how we go about building up that sales book.
And gifting sounds important as well, especially corporate gifting. I mean, how did you have the idea for that?
I have to hand that over to my co-founder Laura. She saw the market in corporate. I think she was, you know, we were getting some of these inbounds and they were saying, can I get a bag of popcorn with my logo on it for my wedding or for my film event or book launch event or whatever it was. And she just saw the inquiries come in and thought, oh, we're missing a trick here. There's definitely a demand in this market. Popcorn's an interesting snack. It's not the same as crisps. Obviously in CSN, crisp snacks and nuts, crisps are by far the biggest part of that category in the UK. Popcorn's, I think it's less than 10% of the entire CSN. It's very small. But actually popcorn as a snack, it's one of those products that lends itself very, very well to corporate gifting. So yeah, Laura saw the demand coming in from buyers on that. And some of them were quite nice volumes. And some of them were gifting. Some of them they were just looking for personalized or branded popcorn. And we developed a bit of a corporate offering and we've just built that out over the years and we continue to sell it. And it's a very nice channel to have.
Is the business seasonal at all?
Yeah, it is seasonal. So we do most of our business in the run up to Christmas, which is the biggest gifting season of the year for all UK specialty brands, I think, and in gifting. So yeah, our busy season starts from sort of mid-August onwards and goes right through to the end of December. And then we have seasonal products that we bring in only for those months, like the advent calendar, like some of the Christmassy flavors. But certainly the gifting side, that's when a lot of those gifting purchases happen. And we see an uplift on all channels. It's not just wholesale, but you know, wholesale goes up and then e-commerce goes up. E-commerce probably a bit later, sort of November, December, and wholesale's normally a bit earlier because they buy in the stock earlier and then they obviously sell it through for Christmas.
And then you've looked at other occasions as well to try and sort of balance that?
Yeah. So this year we launched a popcorn Easter egg, which was a new product for us in 2024, which is a milk chocolate, Belgian milk chocolate Easter egg. And then inside it's got basically popcorn stuck to the inner surface of the egg. It's enrobed into the shell of the egg. So that's a really lovely product for Easter. We do a popcorn tins range as well, where we do a Happy Easter tin And then we developed a Easter flavor this year, our what we call our bunny mix, our Easter bunny mix. It's a chocolate trio. It's a mix of milk chocolate, white chocolate, and cocoa caramel chocolate in a box. So yeah, we develop a bit of an Easter range. We do some bits and pieces for Valentine's, Mother's Day, Father's Day. But I'd say Christmas is very much the focus, and then Easter slightly smaller, and then the other occasions. I mean, we've tried Father's Day products in the past, but popcorn doesn't really lend itself to a snack for a male audience that much. It's mostly female. So I'd say most of our consumers, I don't have the stats, but I think it's probably about 70% female. So when you buy gifts for fathers on Father's Day, I think it's more like beer and, you know, pork scratchings and stuff like that. It's, and peanuts maybe, but not so much the sweet popcorn.
And you say you're selling outside the UK. How easy or feasible has it been to kind of expand internationally? And is there anything, have you had any help? Are there things that have helped you with that?
During the journey, we had the DIT, the Department for International Trade, a member of their trade staff basically were allocated to our business, and they helped us formulate a bit of an export action plan in the early stages. And that definitely focused our minds in terms of which countries to target, which ones maybe have the consumers the right affluence level, and that the popcorn category was familiar to the consumer in those markets. So that, I think the export action plan definitely helped us crystallize the strategy in terms of which countries to target. They helped us along our journey, and we've had help, you know, over the years from not just the DIT actually, but you know, a couple of other agencies as well to, you know, source buyers and, present product and help with, you know, labeling, foreign language labeling, things like that to help us grow the business internationally. And we've done a few international trade shows as well. We were at ISN this year, which is a big sweets and snacks trade show in February, where we see some of our current customers and obviously pick up new business. I think it's just grown organically over the years with a bit of a strategy behind it. And we just, you know, we've gone with it. If there's demand, you know, we'll run with it. Our typical model for international growth is international distributor in market in, say, Germany or France or wherever. And then we sell it to them, and then they obviously sell it locally in their market. That's typically our model.
And then I guess that was then fed into online sales internationally or not?
Not so much, actually. It's been really difficult since Brexit to make a sustainable international e-commerce business, particularly with a product like popcorn, which is bulky and takes up a lot of volume. And so, you know, for a small business to start storing product in Europe and hoping that it will sell, you know, with a broad range that we've got as well, that's been quite challenging. So we do service international customers on our website, and we have a small presence on Amazon Europe, for example, but a lot of that stock is sourced from UK, and then the shipping costs are quite high, and yeah, it's a relatively low value product. So it's not been that easy to scale the e-commerce side of the business. Much easier for us to scale on the wholesale side using the model that I've described.
How big is the team, and how has that grown, and are there particular roles you've wanted to have in-house and things that you've left as outsource?
Yeah, so we are 6, soon to be 7 people full-time in our London office. And then we have a couple of contractors that work for us as well that are offshore. So our first hire was an operations guy helping with, you know, the day-to-day running of the business, processing orders, making sure that, you know, deliveries got to the customers, dealing with any issues, etc. And then our second hire was obviously on the wholesale sales side, and then the digital marketing to support the e-com growth. So I think those are the core hires that we've made. And I think the directors' roles have changed over time. I mean, my co-founder is sales director. She very much leads on the wholesale sales side, and she's obviously upskilled in that area, having had 8 years experience now doing it. And my role was originally, it was more operations focused, and now it's sort of got slightly more bias towards finance and, you know, commercial director. Obviously, I'm, you know, pricing and looking at the commercials is so key to building a sustainable, profitable business. And that's what I spend a huge amount of my time doing now. And the day-to-day operations is kind of dealt with by other people.
The finance side's been quite more volatile over the last couple of years and probably prior to that as well.
Well, it's, I mean, obviously we've had this massive spike of inflation, which has been really challenging for a lot of food and drink producers, and we've been no different. Pushing through some of those price increases, though, with our customer base, I think has been maybe not as difficult as maybe pushing it through with supermarket. I don't know. I've not traded with a supermarket, so I can't really speak. I've not got direct experience there, but I think we obviously, every brand and every product's been in the same boat with in relation to the inflation situation over the last year or two. So there's definitely been a justification. And in some sense, I think buyers are expecting it when we put a price increase through, and we have to explain why we've done it and back it up with figures. But you know, this year now, we're looking at chocolate prices have gone, they've doubled basically since January, cocoa prices. And we have a lot, we deal with a lot of chocolate, you know, chocolate coated caramel popcorn products, our make at home toppings kits, largely chocolate based. And now that chocolate price is now having a further inflationary impact on certain products. Mm-hmm. So it's been really challenging. And certainly, I think also during COVID, the packaging prices went nuts because everyone was buying cardboard to send out all these postal boxes. So yeah, I can't say it's been a particularly stable time over the last 3 years in terms of the pricing and the financing and procurement side of it.
And can I ask how you funded the business so far?
So we started off, the directors put some money into the business as directors' loans, and we had a friends and family round very early on just to get us off the ground in terms of buying in the stock, getting our packaging designs finished and so on. And then we had a small amount of bank funding, bank loans. And there's a scheme, I don't know if it's still around actually, but it's called the Startup Loan Scheme, where the government, it would be government backed loans to businesses, which we took advantage of. So that's how we did it. A combination of those three things. And we've never, you know, fortunately never taken on angel investment or...
You've never given any equity away kind of thing?
Well, last year we had a slight change to our company structure, where we brought on a non-executive director who took a small shareholding. In relation to his role, but he's, you know, we changed company structures. He's now he's part of the board and he's a director, and he helps us run and scale the business. But we've never gone and done a crowdfunding campaign or gone and got angel investment in the traditional sense. No.
Is there anything you wish, or are there any things you wish you could go back and tell yourself back in, say, 2016 that would have saved pain and stress and, you know, or you would have done differently?
Gosh, that's a question. I think there's been a much bigger focus on pricing and margins over the last 3 years, maybe sparked by some of the inflation that was going on. But also, we realized, you know, if you're going to grow the business, you need to have the money to pay the staff, to pay the office overhead, to pay for the marketing and so on. And I think at the early stages, I think we were too focused on brand and actually getting the sale, whatever the margin. And that's not at all what I would, I sort of regret the first 2 or 3 years where the margins just I think we were operating at a margin which was below industry averages. And we managed to improve our margin over time because we've got some volume coming through. You know, I think, yeah, I think more of a focus on commercials from the early stages was perhaps an oversight and something we've learned and certainly become a lot more sophisticated on now that we are a bit more of a mature business.
Brilliant. That makes a lot of sense. Thanks so much for joining us, Sam. You can find out more, find Stockist and buy online at www.popcornshed.com. You can hear previous Food Fans interviews at frogcop.co.uk/podcast, or of course, search for Food Fans interviews wherever you get your podcasts, as they say. Thanks so much, Sam. That's fascinating. And I look forward to my Christmas gift of some more Popcorn Shed popcorn. Thanks. And I know where
send
she
me your address. I'll send you
some. No, I wasn't fishing. No, but I know now where my wife must have got the idea from, because you mentioned not on the high street. So
there you go.
I now know where that little idea popped up. But really nice to talk to you, and best of luck.
All right, thanks, Stephen.